Let's talk a little bit about Nagarjuna and what I would like to do today. So I think that there are probably people here who have various kinds of experience with Nagarjuna or with this particular book, and some people who are kind of new and have very little experience. And so it will be an interesting challenge to speak in ways which will meet the needs of many of you in different kinds of ways. And so what I thought about doing was to give you a little introduction to who Nagarjuna is and why he's important, and a little bit more texture to how I came to spend the last 38 years of my life pretty intimately with him, I suppose one could say that. And then talk about a couple of themes in the book or in his work that have been particularly important to me over the years, and then look at about a half a dozen of the specific stanzas and look at them in some degree of detail and try to sort of get a sense of how they're valuable, why they might be valuable to you in particular. I'm making some big assumptions about who you are and why they might be valuable to you, but he did write for you. You know, that really was his intention. He really understood, I believe, that he was doing something that was of value for the Dharma over a long period of time. My fellow scholars would perhaps disagree with me for saying such things, but I do believe that's the case. And in going through the stanzas, what I'd like to do is look at a particular stanza, I'll read the stanza, read the commentary on it, give my own idea about what's happening, and then let's talk about that. I would very much like to have this be very interactive. As a teacher, it's really boring for me to hear myself talk. I can't tell you how boring it is for me to hear myself talk. And this is lemon ginger tea, and it keeps my throat alive. So there's no possibility of getting through a couple of hours of talk for me without it. My students at the university, I'm sure, believe that this particular cup is an appendage of my right hand because they always see it connected to me when I'm teaching. So, Nagarjuna. So, in this place, you recite the Heart Sutra relatively frequently. I do remember that. And when I go to teachings, for example, that the Dalai Lama gives on anything in the wisdom tradition of Buddhism, the teachings will begin with a recitation of the Heart Sutra. So the Heart Sutra is the pithiest, well, almost the pithiest of the perfection of wisdom class of sutras. And if you spent time with the Heart Sutra, you know, you'll recognize relatively quickly that it seems to be saying some very odd things. Some things are very contradictory. The degree of their oddness often depends upon the translation as to how odd they sound. But even with the very best translations, the Heart Sutra says some things that seem a little bit difficult to understand. And in Nagarjuna's time, which is 2nd, 3rd century AD, people felt the same way. They felt that there were things in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras that were very difficult to understand. At that time, though, I think many people understood that these things were difficult to understand for ordinary people. They were not difficult to understand for bodhisattvas. In fact, they were the way bodhisattvas saw things. But being ordinary-type people, that didn't work quite so well for them. And Nagarjuna set out to systematize in very kind of rational and logical way what was in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So if one wanted to understand some of the odd things in the Heart Sutra, Nagarjuna would be the person that one would study to understand those things. However, there is another slight problem, which is he was alive in the 2nd, 3rd century AD in northeast India, and he wrote in very pithy kinds of verse, which was meant to be memorized. So he wrote in stanzas that were roughly four lines in Sanskrit, and the idea was you'd memorize those things because people didn't have books. There were books in the libraries in the ancient monasteries, but generally speaking, the nuns and monks did not have books, so they had to memorize what they needed to study. And so Nagarjuna wrote in this very pithy style, and of course then over the centuries that led to people needing to explain Nagarjuna to people of succeeding generations, because that's just the way it is with understanding and language. Now, having, you know, memorizing things is a good thing, and in fact people's memories were quite amazing, so we are relatively certain about some of the texts as far as the specific words are concerned, but we're not always certain about the meaning. In fact, Jeremy mentioned Taratuku, who was my teacher of a number of years ago. He died in 1991, and through fortunate circumstance, a friend of his from old monastic days in Tibet took up my guidance and Kay's guidance afterwards, and we've been studying with him for quite a number of years. He mentioned that in the old monasteries, the monks and nuns were very, very poor. So memory was a very good thing because they couldn't afford butter lamps. So in the evening, he could sit in his monastic cell and he could remember the text, and he would even imagine turning the pages of the text in his memory as he was doing his studies. So we're not really too familiar with that level of memory, to say the least, but they did have it. And that actually made it very helpful to understand the texts. Now, after Nagarjuna's time, the kind of tradition of studying middle way philosophy, of which he's a great exemplar, was passed in many directions, you know, as Buddhism spread out from India through Central Asia to China and ultimately to Japan through the Zen tradition. It also spread down to Southeast Asia and through various parts of India. Different kinds of interpretation followed with that different kind of spread. There was a significant scholarly school of interpretation of Nagarjuna in India. There was also a significant scholarly school of interpretation of Nagarjuna in China, which is something that's not extremely well known. But by, say, Dogen's time, which was then the Sung Dynasty in China, that tradition of scholarship had faded away. And it wasn't for lack of interest on the part of the Buddhist communities. But in the 8th century, in particular in China, there were actually a number of anti-Buddhist persecutions. And the monasteries that specialized in scholarship often didn't survive those persecutions because they required an entire apparatus of time and state support in order to maintain that kind of scholarship. So the scholarly interpretation of Nagarjuna really died off in China and was not transmitted to Japan. So when you look at Nagarjuna through Zen eyes, you can see him. It requires a little bit of interpretation, and it's not completely apparent. On the other hand, in India, the traditions were maintained, and there was state support for the monasteries for quite a long time. But as you also may know, Buddhism died off in India in the 13th century. Now, fortunately, before it died off, it came to Tibet. And in the process of Buddhism coming to Tibet, there was a need to be systematic about the study of Buddhism, because Buddhism is an incredibly rich corpus of information. The Tibetans were kind of wild and woolly. They were world conquerors at the time Buddhism was first coming to Tibet. One thinks of Tibet as a very small and isolated area with very peace-loving people. Which has been true for several hundred years, but in the 7th and 8th century, they were actually imperial, Asia-conquering empire, very, very powerful. But anyhow, they imported Buddhism, and as a result of that, became very peaceable. Along the way, there was a need to be systematic about understanding Buddhism. And a particular figure in the 11th century that I want to mention by the name of Atisha came to Tibet from the great monastic university of Nalanda, which was near the Buddhist place of enlightenment. If you go to hear the Dalai Lama talk, he'll often say, well, we're all in the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism. That's how he explains his own way of understanding things. And that's because of the influence of Atisha in Tibet. He essentially wrote an encyclopedia of Buddhism, and he said, these are all the important texts that you need to study. These are all the important figures that you need to study. And that became the basis for both the scholarly and the practice tradition in Tibet. And this is the point that I want to make. Because one of the things that Atisha wrote was that if you want to understand middle way philosophy, you do need to study Nagarjuna. So that's the point of authority in that tradition for knowing why Nagarjuna is important. And in particular, there are two books that you want to study, and one of them is the 70 stanzas on emptiness. And he says, all the arguments for understanding dependent arising or dependent origination are in the 70 stanzas. So that's the text you want to study for that particular purpose. And so, of course, that would then be the reason why ultimately the Dalai Lama's brother says to me, David, if you want to study Buddhism and understand something, you need to study this material. And that's the lineage, if you will, of this material. Yes, question.
The second text, you said there were two?
There were two. The main text that Nagarjuna is known for is called the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, which means the root of the central path of wisdom, if you will, broadly translated. And the 70 stanzas on emptiness is usually considered rather secondary, which is good fortune for me because that means when I was a graduate student, nobody had translated it, and that gave me the opportunity to do that.
So Atisha said those are the two texts.
Those are the two main Nagarjuna texts that you want to study, those two. Right. Okay, so much for the scholarly tradition. By the time I was a graduate student, all the Western scholars said, yes, we know Nagarjuna is important. He's the greatest logician. And that was sort of it. They thought he was a logician. And when I began to study the material, I thought, that's really missing something. I think there's something else going on here in Nagarjuna. He's not just a logician. He is. He's very logical and very rational. But there's something else that's going on here. And I couldn't find anybody in the United States who could help me understand that. I mean, I was consulting with people like Maz Nagatomi, who was the great Sanskritist at Harvard. They all said the same thing. So I went to India, and that's where I met Geshe Sonam Rinchen at the Tibetan Library. And I said, you know, I have some questions about the 70 stanzas in Nagarjuna. Can you give me an answer to the following question? And I wish I could tell you what that question was. It was the summer of 1982, and it was a burning question, and I was dying to know the answer to it. And so here I am at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives up in the Himalayas, and I asked this question that nobody in the United States has been able to address. And he says, which answer do you want? And I said, what do you mean, which answer do you want? Which answer do I want? What do you mean, which answer do I want? And he said, there are three ways of answering this question. And I thought, I almost fell off my chair. Like, in the United States, I can't find anybody that can answer the question anyway. One way, no way. He says, three. So, okay. And so that's really where the book came from, because I thought, we have to work together. Let's retranslate this. And let me collect the oral commentary from this teacher about all these different ways of understanding Nagarjuna. And so that's really what's in the text. When you look at the text, you see that there are the stanzas, but then there are this long paragraphs sometimes of commentary from Geshe Sonam Rinchen. This is the oral tradition of interpreting this. And in particular, the oral tradition is focused on what does Nagarjuna have to say for us who are Buddhist practitioners who want to free ourselves from our own delusions, who want to free ourselves from what's called cyclic existence, but that's just the repetitive stuff of our doing the same thing over and over again that's always getting us in trouble, not making us very happy, and we keep doing it anyway. How do we break free of that kind of thing? How do we see reality clearly for what it is? And I believe deeply that that's what Nagarjuna's intention was. And Gensona Rinchen said, yes, that's what it is. And that's what the commentary is to bring that forth. So having said that, I'd like to move into some of the specifics that are in the commentary. But I'd also like to stop for a minute, because I've been talking for 25 of them. And are there any questions at this particular point, or observations, or curiosity, or whatever the case may be, before I go forward?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Just to clarify, so this book that you've written is an oral commentary that you translated from a Rinpoche in Tibet who correct. Knew the answer to this to
that's
this
correct.
Question.
That's
that,
correct.
That knew, who knew these teachings from Nagarjuna.
That's correct. That's correct. The scholars tend to work with the literal traditions and the literal texts that you'll find in various scriptural collections and translate them according to very specific language. This is what this means in Sanskrit and so on and so forth, which comes up a little bit dead. But there's a living tradition of interpreting the philosophy and putting it into practice. And that's what I was interested in. And that's what Geshe Sonam Rinchen shared. And that's what's in the commentary, is the living tradition of how do we understand Nagarjuna and how do we practice with Nagarjuna in our own lives? Not just what does the text say, but deeply what does it mean for us as Buddhist practitioners?
Yeah, that's
okay. All right? Okay. So, I said there were a couple themes that particularly interested me, and I'll try and expand on them as we work through the specific stanzas. But my thought, nevertheless, is to work with the specific stanzas. Now, the two themes that I'm particularly interested in working with, one is, of course, the relationship of dependent origination or dependent arising and emptiness. That those are viewed in the tradition as, in a sense, flip sides of the same coin. So we'll address that. But the second one, which I actually find somewhat more important in my own practice, is what's the difference between how we experience things when we're on the meditation cushion and when we're off the meditation cushion? How do we look at this philosophy from the point of view of living daily life, which is sort of off the cushion, and look at it from the point of view of sitting in the meditation cushion, where we have a much more focused mind, perhaps doing a more analytic, deconstructive type of meditation anyway, if you're in the Tibetan tradition. Or from a Zen point of view, if you're not allowing yourself to get thought caught by specific thoughts, you kind of get into a different state than when you're kind of driving your car on the freeway and doing the sort of things that Bay Area life is all about. As I'm remembering now that I'm back here. So these are two kind of themes that I want to work with, and I hope they'll be revealed as we work through the stanzas.